From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the campus of Ithaca College. The chair of the Ithaca College Republicans wanted to increase the range of political ideas at the college. He was concerned that everything about Ithaca was liberal, but not just that it was liberal. He thought it was liberal without the occasional balance of conservative ideas, even in the classroom, even as just an idea to consider. So according to the Ithacan, Roger Custer published a report for the college community to read. It was called The Case for Intellectual Diversity. He wanted to document institutional bias toward liberal ideas and against conservative ideas. Custer wrote that diversity is celebrated at Ithaca as long as it's not ideological diversity. Now, you might think that Roger Custer wrote this report in the wake of Donald Trump's victory, but the report I'm referencing was published in 2004. There's been a longstanding debate about whether college campuses have become too liberal, or what to do about that. Writing for Reason magazine, reporter Robbie Suave recently published a piece titled Cornell University Students Vote Against Intellectual Diversity on Grounds It Would Harm Diversity. Reason has been cataloging similar stories across the country, looking at how professors donate to political causes, for example. Various publications have pointed out that 96% of Cornell faculty political donations are given to left-of-center candidates and causes. This hour, a conversation about whether we should feel any urgency to change this. Let me go ahead and welcome my guest for the hour. On the line with us is the reporter of that Reason piece. Robbie Suave is a reporter and staff editor for Reason.com and Reason Magazine. Robbie, thanks for taking the time for the program today.
Thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you.
With us in studio is Chris Hodgman. He's a sophomore at the University of Rochester and a member of the College Republicans. Chris, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Stephen Brower is here. He's an associate professor of English at St. John Fisher College. Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much, Evan.
I'm going to start with you, Robbie. The piece on Cornell is just an example. Give me a sense for what you reported about what's going on at Cornell and then how you think that might fit into the wider picture of what's going on campus.
Yeah, at Cornell, the student government voted against establishing a sort of asking the faculty to perhaps establish a commission to look into whether we could enhance ideological diversity. So it was a very limited suggestion, almost more than an actual proposal or measure that was voted against, that was voted down by the student government. Which is pretty par for the course. I cover these things, and everyone would agree that there is a leftist, liberal-leaning bias in academia. The students, it's the most popular viewpoint. And there's nothing wrong with that. No one's saying that, you know, you should, least of all me, saying that you should, you know, be forced to not have that view or something. But I worry that our students are not prepared to live in a world where, like, half the country has a vastly different political ideology. If they're never being exposed to anyone who disagrees with them in the college setting. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about is seeking ways to increase ideological diversity.
All right, Professor Brower, should we be concerned about this issue?
Well, my first question would be, how are you defining ideology? Because I'm actually, ideology manifests itself in all sorts of forms. So do you mean politics?
But Steve, you don't deny that professors, by and large, are left-leaning in this country, right?
I'd be careful about talking anybody in the country, personally. So my area of knowledge has to do with Fisher. I never talk about politics with my colleagues, and I don't know people who do.
Okay.
So, like, who people voted for instance, it's not something that comes up. Like, when we talk as a group, we tend to talk about our kids and what we try to do over the weekend and whatever hobbies. Probably fairly common workplace
but
conversations.
You don't think college professors are liberal, largely speaking?
I think that in pockets, that's probably the case. I teach at a college that has 5 schools. I'm very wary of defining what my colleagues, my excellent colleagues in business, in pharmacy, and in nursing. I don't know that. I'd be actually very wary of presuming.
Okay, so you don't want to speak too broadly on that. Okay.
Yeah, and I'd also say then, one of the things that I worry about is the sort of the totalizing of this is the way people are. So I teach at a nice local college here in Rochester. But the schools that Robbie often references, and just quickly what I'm looking at, tend to be very well-known, strong schools. But there are 1.5 million professors out there. What we might call the elite institutions are not necessarily equivalent to all college faculty. In other words, I know a lot of people at the University of Rochester My workplace is radically different than theirs just because of the type of different school it is.
Okay, but let me just, and sure. We're going to go back to Robbie, and I'm going to have Chris weigh in on his perception as a student in just a moment here. Yeah. But just exploring this idea of whether we can speak generally, I'm with you, Steve, that you ought to be careful not to overgeneralize. Having said that, there have been a number of studies about this, and I'm just going to give you some examples of data that we've collected on this subject. The Washington Post, a year ago, in their story on this issue, they say in 1990, according to survey data by the Higher Ed Research Institute at UCLA, 42% of professors identified as liberal or far left. But in 2014, that number was 60%. Over the same period, the number of academics identifying as moderate fell by 13 percentage points, and the share of conservative and, quote, far-right professors dropped by nearly 6 percentage points. And in academia, liberals are now outnumbering conservatives roughly 5-1. Then if you look at some other sources of information, here's just an example from NPR. During last year's commencement season, 25 Democratic political leaders were invited to give commencement addresses at 60 top universities. Zero Republicans were invited to that same group. So I'm with you. I don't want to overgeneralize, but I think it's pretty fair to say that academia is liberal.
It might be. I mean, but let me give you a commencement example. Faculty don't have anything to do, generally speaking, with who comes to commencement. That's a Board of Trustees decision. That actually really isn't our decision to make at all.
You don't think that reflects, though,
Board reflects faculty
the disposition
concerns?
Not in my school. College campus? No?
No, gosh, okay. No. And that's fine. In fact, okay. To speak to, I mean, this is why I'm asking questions about how are we defining ideology.
Sure.
Because I think that term is too readily conflated with a lot of different things. And how does it manifest itself is actually an important conversation.
Well, how we define that, Robbie, go ahead. I know you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm actually in agreement with a lot of the professor's points. This problem is far worse at elite Ivy League, coastal institutions, large public universities in certain parts of the country. The problem is much less severe at smaller schools, at schools in rural parts of the country. So that's definitely true. And it's different in depending on what kind of department we're talking about. The mm-hmm. the liberal arts, the humanities, some of the social sciences are kind of overrun, I would say, at especially the elite schools with kind of over the top, very one sided leftist ideology. You know, in other departments, you don't have the problem nearly to that extent. And I would also say that I don't primarily think this is like the faculty are a problem here or something. Actually, it's the students themselves who are so far left, or at least the most vocal ones on many college campuses, and they're actually trying to shut down their professors. You can ask sometimes liberal professors have written articles about how they're terrified to express their views in the classroom because they think they're going to be targeted by the students who are even more kind of hysterically far left, who kind of have an victimhood mentality and think that they have some right to shut down speech that offends them, and so actually I'm worried about the even liberal professors that they're going to be in trouble, let alone a professor with a kind of even more strongly dissenting conservative viewpoint.
All right, so let me bring in Chris Hodgman. He's a sophomore at the University of Rochester and a member of the College Republicans. How do you feel about let's do both the student body and professors, as a young conservative, do you feel welcome? You feel your ideas are welcome? Do you feel, like an endangered species? How do you feel?
Well, I guess we could start with the professors. I do agree that it's not particularly productive to just say make sweeping statements like academia is too liberal, because it doesn't really help solve any kind of problem or work towards any kind of solution. That being said, when you say ideology, I think it's pretty straightforward, especially in certain departments. I mean, you can see it pretty clearly. And you mentioned the statistics, which are definitely important, but you can also just see real life examples. You know, professors will post things on their doors, some kind of political campaign or something going on at the school. They'll post some kind of message or some kind of graphic relating to that. And going to the students, I've never really had a problem with that because I'm not particularly worried of what people think of what I say. I try not to say too much, but I mean what I say, so I'm not particularly concerned. But I'm just thinking of a conservative student walking up to his professor's door, perhaps talk to something about a controversial assignment, something like that, and seeing a blatant display of a very left-leaning political opinion. I'm not sure if they would feel welcome. Now, of course, it's the professor's right to do so, but you see this all the time, and I think you can say to a certain extent in some areas it is institutional.
All right, so what I want to establish then is if we think number one, is there any agreement there that there is a quote-unquote problem here? And if there is there anything that can be done about it? And listeners, if you want to weigh in on this as we talk about ideology on campus, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Robbie, let me start with you on this. Is there any sort of, you know, do you bring any sort of view to this discussion that says that campuses can or should do anything to increase ideological diversity among, well, I guess among the students or the staff, but is there anything that can or should be done?
Well, I'll answer that. To your earlier question, yep. Is it a problem? I mean, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, the American Association of University Professors, and PEN America, a free speech organization, have all published reports in the last year saying, and these organizations representing kind of a range of viewpoints, all publishing reports saying we are concerned about the dialogue on the situation on college campuses because it seems hostile to free speech, which ends up kind of being hostile to non-dominant leftist views. So what is the solution is an interesting question. I mean, in some sense, you just have to reaffirm to students and professors that they do have, that, especially if you're at a public university campus, that they do have these rights to say things that just express viewpoints that might offend others because others have a different point of view, that this is exactly what we should be having is an exchange of ideas, that bringing speakers to campus who will make some people upset because they have a conservative viewpoint or a libertarian viewpoint, that's absolutely right and good and correct for a university to do that, even if students don't like it or certain professors don't like it, although, again, it's usually the students here. So they could just, the university could just reaffirm its commitment to kind of honoring a environment where we have this robust exchange of ideas. But that said, the universities do think that they can kind of, that enhancing diversity is an important goal when making hiring decisions, when making admissions decisions. I don't necessarily agree with that, but they certainly think it is to contribute to socioeconomic diversity and racial diversity. And I wonder if they think that's important, why they don't think intellectual diversity should be some sort of requirement as well. That seems more important.
Okay,
than the other thing.
So that leads me to two questions for Professor Brower. Number one, should it be a goal for universities to have as balanced an ideological spectrum of professors as they can? Is that a worthwhile goal? In other words, if a campus, and now we're being hypothetical,
sure,
if a campus is largely left-leaning, you know, as Cornell, 96% of Cornell professors, when they give to causes, are giving to left-leaning causes or candidates, is that a problem?
Well, I certainly would encourage a faculty to be able to help students think about issues or problems, texts. I'm an English professor, from a variety of perspectives. So I certainly would encourage that. I think if we're thinking about what we're trying to help our students do, develop critical thinking skills, being nimble enough to think about things from different perspectives, that's certainly something we'd want to encourage as much as possible. Now, Robbie, you switched your words from intellectually diverse before we were talking about ideologically diverse. Now, my question about that is, it's illegal for me to ask a candidate for a position in my department their ideology. I'm not allowed to ask that. And I think that's the case at most workplaces. So I'm not sure, and maybe this points you to your second question, how exactly I would pursue that. And I can get into the deal about what it deals with grad students,
et cetera. Well, I think that's a fair point to raise, Steve, but let me just read this. And this comes from a listener named Tess, and Megan Mack, producer, once she gets off the phone and all the phone lines are filled, we're going to probably spend the rest of the hour with your phone calls, which
sure.
is great.
Yeah.
But a listener just sent me a story from WHO-TV. That's in Des Moines. And here's the story. Proposed bill would base university hiring on balance of professors' political ideology. And I'll just read from their story. Senate Democrats in the Iowa State Senate are speaking out after a bill was recently introduced that would drastically change how state professors are hired. Republican Senator Mark Shelgren of Ottumwa's proposed bill would freeze professor hiring at state universities until the faculty is balanced in terms of political ideology. This means, for example, a professor registered as a Democrat would not be hired unless the amount of Democrats and Republicans faculty members at the school is within 10% of each other. While the bill's language calls it partisan balance, some senators called an attack on academic freedom. So who knows where that goes, Steve, but that's an example of something that's happening,
sure.
I think, and we're going to try to verify
that. No, I think
that's
happening
right.
in a number
so
of places.
So please take that with a grain
sure.
of salt, and maybe
yeah,
Robbie can weigh in a second on that. But Steve, Would you be comfortable with that if there was a rule that said at Fisher, you have to hire with it, you have to hire within 10% of registered Republicans, Democrats, et cetera, you know, that kind of thing?
Well, I think it'd be, would I be comfortable with that? So my first response is, boy, that would be easy to poke holes in. For instance, I don't belong to a political party myself.
Okay.
So how would I count?
So you can fudge it.
Yeah, and okay. I think you could fudge it. You could disassociate yourself from a party. But so that's ways around it.
Okay.
Again, this comes back to how we're defining ideology. If you're framing it only within politics, that is a type of ideology that's actually fairly narrow. It speaks perhaps to a worldview, but also doesn't. Let's face it. Lots of conservatives are very environmentally friendly and very concerned about what's going on with the environment. There's a number of Democrats who are not pro-choice. So when we totalize and essentialize party as the thing that defines ideology, I think we're getting ourselves into dangerous waters. Now, the application to knowledge within a political science, a marketing, an English department. To tell the truth, my politics in terms of party never enters into how I think about how I'm going to help students think about the text I'm teaching. It would be hard for me to think about, does my worldview? Oh, absolutely. But that's a different definition of ideology, it seems to me.
Okay. So Robbie Suave from Reason Magazine is joining us by phone. You know, what do you make of that effort in Iowa to at least bring more balance? Is that the right way to go in your view, or does that make sense? Are we going to see more of that?
I wouldn't be comfortable with that either. And again, I agree with the professor I'm not, when I'm using the term ideological, I'm not really talking about party affiliation. I mean, it might very well be the case that more intellectual people more likely to want to teach at a university might even be less likely to identify with a certain party, even if their views would line up with, they might just consider themselves independent. So I'm not stressing that. And I certainly don't think there should be some kind of law to require the hiring of one party or the other, but you might, universities do, or they would like to do, if they're in the extent they're not prohibited by law in certain states, they say, we would like to hire a person of color for this position in the history department. We would like mm-hmm. to hire a woman. They do that. They yep. think that when they establish committees to do hiring decisions. If they're going to do that, why wouldn't you say we would like someone to teach history who approaches history from like a libertarian position or something? That seems to me that would be of greater benefit to the student, bringing in someone with an actually different perspective. And it'd have to be smart and rigorous and worthy of the position in all other ways. But that seems like a fundamentally more important kind of diversity to me than surface considerations like skin color or sex or things like that.
All right, let me turn to Chris Hodgman, and then we go to your phone call. So if you're waiting on the phones, thank you for your patience. Chris, again, is a sophomore at the University of Rochester and member of the College Republicans. And you said earlier this hour that, you're pretty confident with who you are, that you haven't felt sort of pushed around because of your views, even if you're not in a majority view in terms of political or ideology, to use a fraught term, as Steve Brower has reminded us. But would you like to see some efforts, even small, to pursue more diversity of thought on campus?
I definitely would, but not on the government level. I don't think it's up to the government to do that. I think it's more significant and more meaningful if social institutions like higher education, like universities, make a commitment to this. And it doesn't even have to be, sort of ideological affirmative action. I think true conservatives and libertarians would be against that. I think what it has to be is a sort of redefining of the playing field. They have to, reaffirm a commitment to ideological diversity, but also redefine, the terms. Because when you're on a very dominantly liberal campus, or I guess dominantly conservative campus, if you're in that bubble, you start seeing the other side as, you start seeing their political disagreements as character defects. Mm-hmm. So you start vilifying opposing views. So if the university sets the tone for the dialogue, I think that would be much more meaningful than a government initiative to force this kind of red-blue parity.
I opened the hour with the former president of the Ithaca College Republicans, Roger mm-hmm. Custer, in 2004. Chris, what he said then to the Ithacan was this, quote, "The purpose of higher education should be to teach you not what to think, but how to think. And part of knowing how to think is that you understand where other people are coming from and why they might think that, and then form your own view based on that," end quote. You agree?
I completely agree. Not really much more to add to that. I think that's a great way of framing it.
Steve Brower, is that a good way to
Well, I think I tweeted to you about a month ago about George Packer's The Unwinding.
Yep.
And I said, I think this is a really... So I taught a class on the American experience in the fall. And going into it in the summer, I asked my students, there's a lot of stuff going on out there. And I wrote them all an email and said, what would you like us to think about? What questions to ask? And so they came back a lot about, not surprisingly, the election, Black Lives Matter, protest, what's going on right now. So we read a lot about it, but we historicized as much as we could. And as we got closer to the election, we started looking at texts like Packer's to understand what's going on in the country. Texts that have multiple voices. That's part of the power of that book, multiple stories. So I embrace that idea. I think it's actually important. It's the Academy, it seems to me, is a lot about an exchange of ideas, but it's also about a change exchange of perspectives, ways of thinking about things. And I mean, the humanities. So we really don't embrace that there's just one notion of how we approach things. I do think it would be very difficult, the way graduate schools are set up and the way that the job market is set up, to know exactly what someone's position would be. Most graduate students are trained very carefully to write a type of dissertation that gets them a job, and they're not going out on a ledge in these other levels. Because, and that's not surprising, that's the marketplace for so many different industries.
So you're with Chris. Even if we want more diversity of thought, a government rule on how hiring has to be made is fraught with all kinds of loopholes.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think Robbie spoke to that. Like, it's easy enough to disassociate yourself from a party.
Okay. Let me start with your phone calls, and let's start with Herman in Brighton. Thanks for hanging in there. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. Those statistics that you gave earlier that indicated that the college faculty have been becoming more liberal and less conservative, that may reflect the fact that conservatism today, compared to a few decades ago, has become more extreme and more ideological. I mean, a typical conservative, and that's certainly not all conservatives, but typical, it's very common among conservatives to reject science, to reject, for example, climate change, or to reject the theory of evolution. And a university is a place where academic research and science and critical thinking are taught. I just can't see a science professor voting for or supporting a candidate who is like many of the conservatives today, who would, for example, deny climate change. It just doesn't make sense. So I don't think this was necessarily the case 20, 30 years ago, but I think that is part of what is reflected in those statistics, that what today passes for conservatism in general, again, not every, this doesn't go for every conservative, is not something that is would be consistent with a rigorous academic scholarship and scientific research and critical thinking, which is what you would find on college campuses, both among faculty and among students.
All right, Herman, let me just jump in and say, I'm going to kick this to Robbie Suave, a reporter with Reason magazine, first. And what Herman is bringing up is not all that different, Robbie, than what we heard from Matt Lewis, who is a conservative writer who wrote the book Too Dumb to Fail. And in his book, he points out that conservatives used to be at the vanguard of science, that in many ways the Scopes monkey trial kind of started those were the first cracks in what is a much more prominent, you know, this ostensible anti-science view goes all the way back decades. But Matt Lewis says it wasn't always that way and it doesn't have to be that way. So I'm wondering if you agree with him and if you agree with Herman, Robbie, that, you know, Herman's premise is conservatism is more extreme and more anti-academia, anti-research, anti-science. Is that fair or unfair?
It's fair in a sense. Matt Lewis is a friend of mine. Actually, we used to work together at the Daily Caller. I would agree with that thesis. And there are several ways in which you could say conservatism has become more extreme. Or it actually got more kind of celebrity obsessed. The people who are like leaders of intellectual conservatism are kind of crazy figures these days. But just to, you know, play devil's advocate and push back on the caller a little bit, there's a lot of anti-science weirdo leftism out there too. I mean, there are academic far left people who completely reject the scientific consensus on economic science, on whether you know, free markets are good and generally produce prosperity. There are leftist academics who embrace kind of a very I think wrong and against the science views about like whether you're a man or a woman, whether with gender and sex are just completely made up constructs. the kind of, there's anti-GMO kind of hysteria on the left. I don't disagree with the caller that there's a lot of kind of crazy over-the-top conservatism. I wouldn't want someone who denies that kind of everything about climate change to be teaching climate science. I agree with that. But I think colleges do tolerate to a much greater degree some kind of insane views on the left, the people who teach there. I mean, I can point you to, you know, there's news story after news story of a far left college professor saying things in the classroom that are crazy, okay, that most people would agree are crazy.
Chris Hodgman is a sophomore at U of R, and do you have any concern as a young Republican that your party is anti-science?
I think there's definitely a strain of anti-intellectualism on the right. There's one on the left as well. It's usually around different issues, but bringing back to the college environment, there are definitely certain very anti-intellectual and, you know, anti-factual things that have become the norm thanks to this very liberal environment. You know, for example, the myth of the wage gap. When you adjust for certain factors, you realize that it's just not there. Or the very unfortunate 1 in 5 sexual assault statistic, which is a serious issue, but was heavily distorted and is now used to create this kind of hysteria on campus starting with freshman year when you're told this stuff. So I think I do agree that there's a problem on the right, but I think at least in colleges, the liberal bubble has allowed, you know, very untrue things to become accepted fact.
All right, let me just try to make sure, because I don't want to divert the whole hour and have phone calls about the wage gap. So I'll just say what Chris is talking about is when we hear 77 cents, that sometimes implies 77 cents for women, for a dollar for men, for the same work. And that's not the case. Women make roughly 77 cents on the dollar to what men make, but men tend to do work that pays more, and sometimes that is higher hazard jobs, different things. It is different work. When it comes to the same work, the gap is certainly much smaller, though certainly still a gap there. The question is how big it is. It's not 77 cents to the dollar. So please don't send me emails for the rest of the hour. That we'll talk about that on a different day. And I'm late for a break. So let's get back to your phone calls as we continue our conversation about ideology and intellectual diversity on campus. Robbie Suave's piece for Reason Online sparked this discussion, but there's a lot of conversation about this. In fact, The Ithacan just wrote a piece this week about it. You see this kind of debate and conversation all over the place. Robbie Suave is on the line with us. He's a reporter and staff editor for Reason.com and Reason Magazine. Stephen Brower is a professor of English at St. John Fisher College. And Chris Hodgman, who you just heard, sophomore at the University of Rochester, member of the College Republicans. More of your phone calls are next. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about educational opportunity. New York State has an antiquated system of funding schools. Just about everybody agrees, even if there is disagreement about what to do about it. So we're going to talk about how it impacts students in the city of Rochester. They were kind of left out of the conversation last week, but next hour we'll talk about what real educational equality might mean. Do we have to spend more, or can we shift priorities? Let's talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Doug in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that my experience with higher education and professors for many decades is that most professors are academic and they don't act in the political arena. They're very timid, typically. And so the difference between one ideology or another is kind of irrelevant. If students can learn from professors by what they do rather than just what they teach and what they think. And my experience is that there are very few far-left professors in this country who act politically on their ideology. And so my concern is that there's too little of that and too much intellectualizing.
I'll start with the professor in studio, Steve Brower. What do you think about that, Steve?
Well, I think what I was thinking about as it was Doug was speaking was probably personally, I see my work as connected to what I'm doing in the classroom with the students and also my scholarship. And there's lots of moments in which I'm trying to ask students to engage in a type of intellectual inquiry. That I'm trying to frame certain problems for them in some ways. It's a lot about how we read that way. And I try to enact different ways of reading. So it may be a Marxist perspective one day, what it means to read Gatsby, say. What about from a feminist perspective, psychoanalytic? So we do engage in different perspectives as a way to think about what does it mean to read, analyze, what does it mean to learn different models the same ways they would in the social sciences, learn different models of how to think about problems. And that way it echoes. But do I think I enact a politics in my work? Yes, I think everyone does in different ways, but that's a small p politics. From what textbook am I using, which novels am I including, which not, how am I going to approach that? Am I lecturing? Is it more student-centered? There's lots of ways that shows up. What I do outside the classroom, I don't really talk about in my teaching, to tell you the truth, because, I don't know, it's a short semester. I'm trying to focus on what we're trying to get through, and we've got very specific learning goals. I do ask my students, I can't say this. Here's a way in which I'm political in the ways we're talking about. We do often talk about student debt. We do talk about what it means to take out loans. I ask them to make sure, as undergraduates, they've done the math on that. I do ask them to think about the work we're involved in as English majors and how that connects to what they hope to do in their life or not. That sort of education goes on within my particular classroom. I can't talk about all my colleagues, but those are questions I do want them to be engaged in.
Okay. Reason Magazine's Robbie Suave, what do you think?
I think that's true. I think that is the case probably for most professors. And I'm not accusing the whole or the majority of academia of perpetrating some kind of leftist conspiracy to brainwash the students. I don't even think most of the brainwashing occurring on campus is really happening in the classroom these days. When I talk to students, when I look at what's going on, it's all being enacted kind of administratively. It's the residence halls, the dorm rooms actually, are now following policies designed by administrators, student administrators, that say, you know, if you offend someone, if someone else doesn't like what you have to say, you can get in big trouble, that you have to actually preach leftist ideology to the students living in the dorm room. This has been a kind of a plan to make residence halls places where ideology is at the forefront of the experience. And this is happening at several different colleges and universities. So I have more concern about that kind of thing. And again, the environment this creates is that, like, you know, in the wake of the election, you saw at multiple universities, you saw students having panic attacks, having, even before the election, there were campuses where if you drew Trump in chalk on the ground, students treated it like it was a hate crime. They would call the police. I think this kind of hysterical reaction, which is unhealthy because they're in such a bubble and they're not learning to kind of understand what their fellow man thinks, I think it's not healthy, and I think the university is clearly failing in some sense if so many students are unprepared at that level to go back into the real world where people share a wildly different perspective.
I'm going to go to Chris in a second. Is that too broad for you, Steve, or do you?
Well, I always worry about the notion of the real world because, of course, colleges are also the real world. Students live there.
It's like real America is only, you know, the middle parts of America.
Well, sure, I cannot speak to things going on in student housing. I don't see that side of my campus.
Okay.
You know, I think most professors try to avoid.
Yes, well, that's probably for good reason.
We have enough kids at home that we're trying to deal with.
Yeah.
So I can't speak too specifically about that. Do I know students at my campus who were upset following the election and felt that with some of the policies that our now president had been advocating that they felt at risk? Yes, they did. And I was.
Do you think they're weak and unprepared for the world?
Do I think they're weak and unprepared for the world? No. I think they're actually trying to address the world that they feel they live in. Just as much as Chris is trying to address how, when I walk up to that faculty member's office and I see a certain politics on the door, how do I deal with that? That's a very important question for that student to ask and for us to think about as faculty. How do we help all our students feel like the work we're involved in matters, that the people in it all matter, and that we can sort of help them all make their way successfully through that? It's very hard for me to talk about individual, but I actually would take their concerns seriously. What we do about that, that's made on a higher pay grade than I.
Chris, how do politics manifest either in the classroom or on campus as you see them?
Well, you definitely notice it. You know, following the election, we got an email from, I believe it was the university president, and it was this very, very obviously weighted announcement about valuing the international student community, which is not a bad thing. But the timing of it was pretty obviously, you know, politically motivated. The day after the Ohio State University terrorist attack, a bunch of posters about tolerance went up in my hallway, which, again, tolerance, not a bad thing at all. But again, the timing was obviously politicized. Right. So obviously, you know, all protests are almost exclusively left-wing on a campus. So yeah, it definitely does manifest itself.
Before I get back to your phone calls, producer Megan Mack and I reached out to just about every, I think every, school in roughly our region, and we just asked them a couple of questions. Is your institution concerned with the lack of intellectual diversity in your professorial ranks? Are you taking any steps to promote or increase intellectual diversity on campus? Just about every, well, Nazareth gave us a no comment. Everybody else gave us a, you know, if I'm going to be honest about it, and I know a lot of these folks. They work hard to craft a statement that's a paragraph or two that doesn't say very much. They say things like, you know, we value diversity of all kinds, intellectual diversity is great, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. I'll give you an example of a couple that sent statements that are, I think, a little bit beyond that. St. John Fisher College, where Steve works. This is from Dr. Kevin Raley, who's the provost.
Sure.
He writes, we have people from across the political spectrum at St. John Fisher College, students, faculty, and staff alike, and we want all of them to feel welcome and included. We are an intellectually open community and a microcosm of the world in which we live. We do not exist in a vacuum. We also understand that diversity is often a politically charged term and a word whose definition has become vague. It elicits immediate emotional reactions from all sides of many debates. In line with our values here at Fisher, we are very concerned with equity, equity of expression, equity of representation, equity of opportunity, and all the things that get in the way of true equity in our society. If we all focus more on equity and its obstacles, we can leave the vague connotations of the word diversity behind. That comes from Fisher. Finger Lakes Community College sent this, quote, while FLCC is committed to a diverse and inclusive campus, this particular issue has not arisen as a topic. It may be that community college students are more likely to have immediate concerns about juggling jobs and families, or that some of our degree programs focus on applied knowledge, such as culinary arts, viticulture, and wine technology, mechanical technology, which are less given to ideological discussion. This is certainly an interesting topic, but not a significant one for us at this time.
It was the wine that made you read that, right?
Well, you know, no, FLCC basically saying it's not on our radar. Right. I doubt Robbie Suave from Reason, I doubt there's any surprise in that to you. But, you know, I guess I'm curious to know what you and the staff at Reason would like to hear from schools when they get asked those questions.
I mean, I would like to hear that they take it very seriously and they do want to make available whatever resources are being made to students to hear left-of-center perspectives, that they're making resources available as well, equally and fairly, to hear from other perspectives. I mean, I graduated at the University of Michigan. I graduated, 2010. When I was on campus, Bill Ayers came to campus, the kind of weather underground, some people would call him a domestic terrorist that's been used in right-wing circles. I got to interview him. It was kind of the first important person I interviewed as a someone who wanted to be a journalist. Was very exciting for me. No one protested him, even though he is a controversial person that a lot of people would dislike for not without cause. Today, Ben Shapiro or Milo Yiannopoulos show up on campus, and they're actually the students are smashing windows. They're setting fires. I don't know if you saw what happened at Berkeley. I mean, they actually
a lot of what happened at Berkeley though wasn't really Berkeley students, Robbie, right?
Yeah, the explicit sort of property destruction and violence apparently was not in mostly done by the students, but the students show up and they do want to stop the speaker from talking. They do talk over the person. They do shout at it. It's not just kind of polite opposition. We're here to protest, and it's that they actually want the person to not be able to speak, and that is a problem. I think that's a huge. It's ideological. It's not. I don't really blame. It's not. It's sort of a perversion of leftist ideology. Actually, the idea that free speech is dangerous to your point of view and you have some right to shut down something that offends you is what I think is a perversion of liberalism, actually.
Yeah, we often hear from local attorney Chris Thomas and others who work on these cases who say that almost always the antidote for speech you don't like is more speech. And Robbie, I think maybe some students would say, well, we're just shouting at Milo Yiannopoulos because that's our right to speak. But it sounds like what you're saying is you're shouting over him and not allowing him to speak, which is sort of defeating the point. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what they're doing. I mean, they do this all the time. The goal is to shut down, to prevent the event from taking place, which is not the same as answering speech with more speech. It's not formal censorship because it's not the government or the authority figure doing it, but it's a kind of muzzling or silencing at the very least that is not good for a university community. where we should have the most maximum free speech possible, the most number of different perspectives, even if they're heresy or offensive to certain members of us. The students weaponize this idea that they have a right. Not all students, not even a majority of students, but some students, some very vocal, very powerful students on a lot of campuses, particularly campuses, have weaponized the idea that they have a right to exist free from speech that offends them.
All right. Well, somebody who heard Milo speak was Katie in Rochester, who's on the phone. Go ahead, Katie.
Hello. Yeah, I wanted to share an experience I had in my last semester of college. I graduated last April. Around campus, I saw flyers advertising a speaker who was going to speak upon free speech in danger. And that's a topic really important to me. I think that media bubbles are, you know, an epidemic for our society, especially our college students in today's world. So I went to this this speaker, you know, not really knowing who he was, not knowing who was going to be there. And I was met with a totally packed house, divided between, I would say, like liberals and conservatives. And I went in with open ears. I didn't know really much about Milo and his ideology, but what I was met with was truly, I think, borderline hate speech against liberals and feminists and even lesbians. And, you know, I'm not going to repeat what he said. You can go online and find his full speeches on YouTube. But I think that the argument that free speech is on danger from liberals, they don't want, you know, people speaking their minds, that's not true. What a result of this, him coming to my university, was a lot of conversation between liberals and conservatives and the student government, you know, speaking about what is appropriate for a school to support and fund. And Milo was not it. Milo, truly, I was appalled at what he was saying. And, you know, you could say I'm down the line, but what he was saying was totally inappropriate and, you know, could be considered as endangering these groups.
All right, so hold on, Katie. Stay there for 1 second, Katie. And listeners, if you still don't know much about Milo, hopefully you won't. I mean, I think he's kind of going away for a little. Who knows? Milo is very good. Here's what he believes in. He believes in monetizing outrage. He's very good at that. The best actual thinkers, or at least intellectuals in the movement, he's sort of the self-styled intellectual. And there's been a number of good thought pieces. Read Ross, Douthat, and others on Milo, what has made them successful. Or Matt Lewis, among others, by the way, about Milo. Milo monetizes outrage. There's no doubt about it. He's a mm-hmm. large child, and he says things that are going to upset people, and then he gets an audience. And that's a little bit of a reflection on us. Intellectuals should make us think. Milo just makes us angry. I think that was Matt Lewis who said it. I'd like to credit it properly. But he's not an intellectual. But he's out there, and Katie, for you, it might have been offensive, but did you really think what he was saying was endangering anybody? And again, I'm not trying to be a provocateur myself. I'm just asking you, do you think he should not have been allowed to speak?
No, I understand what you're saying. I think knowing who attended this university, people of all walks of life, and how they could bring a speaker there who completely derogatized them and, you know, made clowns out of them. That's just inappropriate for a university to fund. I don't care if this guy, you know, sets up a soapbox and is, like, saying this stuff in the town square, but as far as endangering students, mm-hmm. not endangering them to physical harm, but, you know, emotional. You know, I think the conservatives, they will scoff at that. Don't mean to get political like that, but, you know, you can't just completely ignore how things make people feel, because, you know, then that, you know, contributes to physical reaction. So just reiterating what I'm saying, I think that after that, the groups that he, you know, targeted could have faced discrimination or harassment, you know, because I think that people were revved up on campus saying, yeah, why aren't we letting these people, I don't even know, bother us? Walk on us? It's not true.
All right, Katie, thank you for the phone call. And I'm going to start with Robbie Suave. I know I'd like Chris to weigh in as well from a student perspective. But Robbie, let me start with you. She's saying that we have to at least be mindful of the emotional possible harm. Do you disagree with that?
Well, we can be mindful of it, but you start to run into some problems there. And I mean, the caller handled this, you know, subject with some sophistication and I think was aware that there's subtleties going on here, because you don't want to start saying, well, if someone feels feeling harassed and feeling discriminated against aren't the same thing as actually being harassed and actually being discriminated against. You know, being harassed has a precise legal definition, and we start to get kind of like slippery language, and we're like, well, I felt harassed by this. I mean, if it's totally subjective, we can feel harassed by anything, including a perspective that we should hear because it's correct. I don't think Milo's correct about virtually anything, and I'm glad this went off without a hitch, because then the students get to be educated about how his views are loathsome and how they should reject him entirely. When his speech gets shut down, then the story becomes, it becomes about censorship. People give it more attention. They don't give attention to what he was going to say because he didn't get to say it. They give attention to him as some kind of martyr. And as you said perfectly in your own comments, this is exactly what he's kind of thrived on. But I want his hurtful, harmful views, I want him to be able to express them so that they can be known to us and they can be challenged. And then he can go away. When we shut him down, that's when we end up stuck with him forever.
And in some ways, Robbie's saying when you shut him down, you get, maybe give him more power. In the same way.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So, Chris, what do you think?
I agree that shutting down speakers who are exercising free speech to its limit is ultimately counterproductive. Free speech, it's important to note, is not just the ability to criticize authority. It's the ability to speak to each other. And when it comes to hate speech, pretty much anything short of physically threatening someone is protected. You can look at, for example, when it comes to emotional harm, you could look at the Supreme Court case with the Westboro Baptist Church protesting military funerals. It was ruled that that is their First Amendment right. And as repulsive as that might seem, I agree, because it's important to protect free speech. What's really worrying is when you start conflating allegedly violent speech with actual physical violence. And you could actually go back to UC Berkeley and following the riots where things were burned, windows were broken, people were beaten up by protesters, among whom were students and allegedly staff. That's unconfirmed, but students were definitely involved. Afterwards, following that, both some university faculty and certainly the student newspaper ran a series of editorials basically saying, yes, the violence was justified in supposedly protecting people. I think that's a very dangerous path to start justifying physical violence as a response to speech, no matter how controversial said speech is.
All right, so real tight, Steve Brower, if Milo was coming to Fisher as a professor, would you urge the school to say, hey, cancel that invitation?
No, I think I'd urge them to, whoever was involved, to
yeah.
make sure their multiple voices heard as part of that experience. I'm not an expert here. I'm not a legal expert. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But one of the things I see him creating in his history, his journalistic history, is a virtual space when he will say certain things and both enable and encourage people to follow up with that, so that he's not necessarily someone who's threatening people, but he creates a virtual space where those acts start happening, whether it's with the woman, Leslie Jones or what happened what continues to happen with women who work in the tech industry. He's been part of that harassment. Now, does he do that personally? I don't believe so. But he certainly has thrived off of enabling that and encouraging it. I mean, I think Milo is really good at monetizing Milo. Not even particularly ideas himself. There's not much there, to tell you the truth, when you really question him.
We're down to our last 90 seconds. This hour has flown by. So, Robbie Suave, what's next for you in terms of as you cover this issue? What do you expect to change, and what do you have your eye on next?
Well, I'm going to be interested to see whether Trump's new education department changes some of the guidance the previous administration's education department has given to colleges on what counts as harassment, what they have to do to make their students feel emotionally safe. There was some guidance in the past that I was concerned about, and now I'm interested to see if that kind of gets reversed. So we'll see.
Okay. And Steve Brower, going forward, I mean, I could read a pile of emails from people basically saying, hey, liberalism, academia is natural, just as conservatism, we see more conservatives going into law enforcement. I mean, do you buy into that at all? Do you think that's part of the future here, that it's much more of a natural path for liberals?
Not necessarily. I think, ideas are, I think Chris was, like said, this is where we do it. This is the space where we talk about ideas. We try to solve problems of the future and of the present. And these are think tanks for 18 to 21-year-olds and people who are involved in that education. It's an exciting place for anyone, I hope.
Okay. And Chris, some final thoughts from you on this subject here. I mean, you're not going to be in school forever, but for people who follow in your footsteps, you have concerns about campus, or do you think these kind of dialogues are healthy?
No, I don't think I'm not concerned long term. I mean, there's certainly, as we've just discussed, numerous issues. But I think the people who want to get out there and share their views, you know, in a passionate and assertive but civil manner will ultimately prevail on both sides. So that's what I plan on keeping doing. I think it'll be all right.
Good luck to you. Thanks for coming in. Chris Hodgman's a sophomore at the University of Rochester and member of the College Republicans. Professor Stephen Brower, from Professor of English at St. John Fisher College. Nice to see you, Professor.
Thanks for being here.
And Robbie Suave, reporter and staff editor for Reason.com and Reason Magazine. Robbie, thanks for your time for the entire hour. It's been nice having you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, short break. More connections straight ahead.